RG.
And the WJFF Wonderful Things auction is happening this afternoon. They've just gotten started. It's from 1 to 4 p.m. this afternoon, and it's in Jeffersonville at the Fire Hall. We would love to see you there when you're not listening to the radio. Stay tuned for Now and Then. Support for this program comes from our listeners and from The Cooperage, 1030 Main Street, Honesdale. Be entertained, be challenged, be inspired. TheCooperageProject.org. Kathy Geary, and this is Now and Then. Today's program is a celebration of the life of John Lennon. Here we are. It's a beautiful turning of the seasons, and as fall comes into October, I am always surprised at how it occurs to me that that's when John Lennon was born. John Lennon was born in Liverpool, in England, on October the 9th in 1940. And even though I never knew John Lennon personally, I feel like he is a member of my family. His music with the Beatles and afterwards guided me through large parts of my life. And so every year at this time, it occurs to me that it's John Lennon's birthday. There's been a lot of books written about John Lennon, but none of them were as effective and as in-depth and as incredibly beautifully written as the book that his first wife, Cynthia Lennon, published in 2005. She wrote a book entitled simply John, published on Crown Books in 2005. Cynthia Lennon was with John Lennon when he first started to attend art college, and during 10 years of his life, as he was performing and starting to become a musician, she was at his side. And I was thrilled to discover that this book entitled John by Cynthia Lennon is also available in an audiobook version with Cynthia Lennon herself reading and speaking the text. So on today's program, we'll be listening to excerpts from the book by Cynthia Lennon, and we'll be listening to some music by John Lennon. Let's get started. This is a chapter from the book read by Cynthia Lennon. It's entitled For 10 Years. Here's Cynthia Lennon.
For 10 years, I shared my life with a man who was a huge figure in his lifetime and who has become a legend since his death. Through the years in which the Beatles came together and went on to delight and astound the world, I was with him, sharing the highs and lows of his public and private lives. Since John's death, I've watched shelves full of books come and go, most by people who never knew him and who painted a one-sided, flawed picture of him and our relationship. Many consign me to a brief walk-on part in John's life, notable only because we had a son. I was usually dismissed as the impressionable young girl who fell for him, then trapped him into marriage. That was a long way from the truth. I was at John's side throughout the most exciting, extraordinary, and eventful 10 years of his life. It was a time when he was at his creative best, a time when he was witty, passionate, honest, and open, when he loved his family and loved the Beatles, a time before drugs and fame led him toward the destruction of so much that he had valued. After my marriage to John fell apart, I tried to escape the world of celebrity and the Lennon label by going off to find my own life. I wanted security for our son and a life that was real and purposeful, out of the limelight. Both my privacy and my dignity were important to me, so I preferred to let others do the talking. Now the time has come when I feel ready to tell the truth about John and me, our years together and the years since his death. There is so much that I have never said, so many incidents I have never spoken of, and so many feelings I have never expressed. Great love on one hand, pain, torment, and humiliation on the other. Only I know what really happened between us, why we stayed together, why we parted, and the price I paid for having been John's wife. On Monday evenings, Dad and I would arrive home to find the front room changed. There might be a new sofa, carpet, curtains, table, or even all of them, the old ones already dispatched to the same sale rooms. We didn't mind. And it was always fun to see what she'd done. And most important, it made Mum happy. When Dad became ill at the age of 56, everything changed. Like so many others in those days, he smoked untipped cigarettes, unaware of the damage it was doing to him. When he developed lung cancer, he went downhill rapidly. His solid frame wasted away and his breathing was laboured. Before long, all he could do was sit in his chair in the bedroom, where I would sit with him after school each day. After his death, only Mum and I were left, grieving for him and wondering how we would manage. Art college gave me a new focus, something to be excited about, to work for, and to take me out of our quiet little house of mourning into the world. Watching the older, more confident kids at college, I longed to be like them. I envied their casual, arty style and their long hair. I had arrived with my short, mousy hair in a neat perm, courtesy of my mother's friend who was a hairdresser. Every few weeks she would experiment, giving me a different style, but they were all ghastly, and to make things worse, I wore glasses. I'd arrived at college thrilled to be rid of school uniform and pleased with my smart new clothes. But I soon felt frumpy and dull, with my matronly hair and conventional outfits. I longed to be more daring, but in those early days I didn't have the courage. To add to my problems, I was saddled with the over-the-water, posh image that Scousers had of anyone who lived across the Mersey. I spoke differently, and to them this meant I was stuck up, even though many of them were better off than I was. My shyness didn't help. It made me seem aloof, when most of the time I was going through agonies trying to think of the right thing to say. 2/3 of the way through my foundation year, Phil arrived at college. She had won a grant and had finally persuaded her father to let her attend full time. We were both delighted, and in between classes we hung around together most of the time. At the end of that year, we had to choose which areas we wanted to specialise in. I went for graphics, but I also signed up for a twice-weekly class in lettering. Phil decided on painting and lettering, and we were glad of the chance to do a class together. I arrived for my second year in college just as keen as I had been in the first, but I'd softened my appearance a little. I plucked up the courage to say no to Mum's hairdresser friend and was growing my hair. I'd acquired some rather hip black velvet pants to replace the tweed skirts, and I'd begun to ditch my glasses as often as I could. We had all taken our seats for the first lettering class when a teddy boy slouched into the room, hands stuffed deep into his coat pockets, looking bored and a shade defiant. He sat at an empty desk behind me, tapped me on the back, twisted his face into a ludicrous grimace and said, "Hi, I'm John." I couldn't help smiling. "Cynthia," I whispered, as the teacher, who had begun to talk, frowned at me. I'd seen John around the college but had never spoken to him, as we moved in completely different circles. I was surprised to see him in the lettering class. He didn't seem the type for the painstaking, detailed work involved. He hadn't even brought any equipment. As soon as we started work, he tapped my back again and asked to borrow a pencil and a brush, which I reluctantly handed over. After that, he always sat behind me, borrowing whatever he needed from me. Not that he used it much. Most of the time he did no work at all. He spent his time fooling around, making everyone in the class laugh. When I first looked at John, I thought, yuck, not my type. With his teddy boy look, DA haircut, narrow drainpipe trousers, and a battered old coat that was far too big for him. He was very different from the clean-cut boys I was used to. His outspoken comments and caustic wit were alarming. I was terrified he might turn on me, and he soon did, calling me Miss Prim or Miss Powell, and taking the mickey out of my smart clothes and posh accent. The first time he did it, I rushed out of the room, red-faced, at the end of the class, wishing he'd disappear. But as the weeks went by, I began to look forward to seeing him. A mutual friend told me that his mother had been killed in a car accident at the end of the previous term. I missed my father desperately, so I felt for him. He never mentioned it, and neither did anyone else. But the knowledge that he was hiding grief behind the acerbic front made me look at him more closely. One morning, the students in the lettering class were testing each other's eyesight for fun. It turned out that John and I were equally short-sighted. Just like me, he couldn't see a thing and hated wearing glasses, most of all, ironically, the little round lenses you got on the National Health. Instead, he had horn-rimmed black ones, which had cost quite a bit. Laughing about our rotten luck and the blunders we'd made when we couldn't see gave us our real first connection, and after that we often chatted during class. John usually had a guitar slung round his back when he arrived, and he told me he was in a group, the Quarrymen, named after his old school, Quarry Bank High. Sometimes when we were sitting around after class, he would get it out and strum the pop tunes of the day by Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, or Lonnie Donegan. And as soon as he began to play, I saw a different side of him. It was plain that he loved his music. His face softened, and he lost his usually cynical expression. Halfway through the term, I realized I was falling for him, and scolded myself. I was being ridiculous. He wasn't at all the type of boy I'd imagined myself with, and in any case, I couldn't see him being interested in me. But that changed one day when everyone else had left the class and I was packing up my things. John was sitting a few feet away with his guitar. He began to play Ain't She Sweet, a song that was popular at the time and which the Beatles were later to record. I blushed scarlet, made an excuse, and fled before the end of the song, but I'd seen the look in his eyes, which he'd kept fixed on me as he sang. Could it be that John fancied me too? One lunchtime I saw John staring at a girl as she walked up the staircase. She was dressed in a tight black skirt and had long blonde hair. John whistled, "She looks just like Bridget Bardot," I heard him say to a friend. I wasn't about to be outdone. The following Saturday I went out, got the latest Hilltone blonde dye, and got to work on my hair. On Monday I arrived in college, by several shades blonder. I was delighted when John noticed. "Get you, Miss Hoylake," he laughed, but I could see he liked it.
We're listening to a recording that Cynthia Lennon has made of the book she published in 2005 about her meeting and her marriage to John Lennon when he was just getting started with the Beatles. And she mentioned that John pulled out his guitar and sang her "Ain't She Sweet." And we just heard a really early recording that the Beatles did. They were recording with a man named Tony Sheridan singing lead and the Beatles backing him up. But apparently on this one song, the Beatles actually got to record the whole thing with John singing lead. There was another musician that John Lennon was really influenced by when he was a young man, and that was a man named Lonnie Donegan. Lonnie Donegan was born in 1931. He passed away in 2002, and he was a really big hit in England. He had like over 20 singles in the top 10, and it was a kind of music called skiffle, which featured either guitar and banjo, bass and drums. Let's listen to a couple of recordings from Lonnie Donegan, who was so influential on John. He really specialized in American folk songs. So we're going to hear a song called "Take This Hammer," which was originally recorded and sung by Lead Belly. This is Lonnie Donegan.
Take this hammer, take it to my captain. Take this hammer, carry it to my captain. Take this hammer, carry it to my captain. Tell him I'm gone, tell him I'm gone. Was I running? If he asked you, was I running? If he asked you, was I running? Tell him I was fine. You tell him I was fine. If he was I laughing? Should ask you, love. Was I laughing? If he asked you, Lordy, was I laughing? You tell him I was crying. You tell him I was crying. Take it in hammer. Gonna take it to my captain. Like gold, but he weighs like gold. take my hammer. Hammer gonna take it to my captain. Take my hammer. Please carry it to my captain. Take my hammer. Tell him I'm gone. Tell him I'm gone.
Lonnie Donegan singing a Lead Belly song, Take This Hammer. Today's program, we're celebrating John Lennon's birthday, and we're listening to some excerpts from a book that Cynthia Lennon has written entitled John. Let's listen to Cynthia Lennon again.
We were all getting excited about the holidays when someone suggested we hold a party one lunchtime before we broke up. One of the staff, an ex-boxer named Arthur Ballard, a tough but excellent teacher, gave us permission to use his room, provided he could come too. We happily agreed, found a record player, and chipped in for the beers. The day of the party was warm, and the sun streamed through the grubby windows of Arthur Ballard's first-floor room, where we gathered once a week to produce paintings on a chosen theme. We pushed the tables and chairs to one side, set out the food and drink, and put on a pile of records. The usual gang were there, a group of 10 or 15 of us who'd been friends since our first year. I arrived feeling good. I was wearing a new baggy black cotton top over a short black and white skirt, with black tights and my best black winkle picker shoes. By now, several romances were budding, so the atmosphere was heady. Anne Mason was getting together with Jeff Mohammed, close friend of John's. They smooched away. Phil and I glanced knowingly at each other. Then John walked in. My face was hot and my stomach contorted as I pretended not to notice him. Like me, he was in black, his usual drainpipe trousers with a sweater and suede shoes. He made a beeline for me and said, "Do you want to get up?" I blushed, but leapt to my feet to dance with him. While we were dancing to Chuck Berry, John shouted, "Do you fancy going out with me?" I was so flustered that I came out with, "I'm sorry, but I'm engaged to this fellow in Hoylake." The moment I said it, I wanted the ground to swallow me up. I knew I sounded stuck up and prim. "I didn't ask you to fucking marry me, did I?" John shot back. He walked off, and, convinced I'd blown it, I was plunged into gloom. But a couple of hours later, as the party was breaking up, John and his friends asked me and Phil to the pub. This was good news. Perhaps all was not lost. I persuaded Phil we should go, and we followed them to Ye Crack, a pub where the students often hung out. The place was packed, and we had to yell to each other above the hubbub. We'd never been there before. We'd always headed straight home like the good girls that we were. And this was our first taste of student social life. We loved the noise, the laughter, and the buzzy atmosphere, and realized what we'd been missing. John was with a couple of his cronies, Jeff Mohammed and Tony Carricker, on the other side of the pub, and made no move to come over to us. Phil and I had found some friends and were chatting with them, but after a couple of black velvets, the mix of Guinness and cider that all the students drank, I felt a little wobbly and decided I'd better head for my train home. I was disappointed that John hadn't talked to me and wondered if, after all, he'd been laughing at me when he'd invited me to the pub. As I made for the door, he called me over, teased me about being a nun, and asked me to stay. Phil said she had to get her bus home and asked if I was coming. I knew she didn't approve of John, but I was hooked. If he wanted me to stay, I was staying. I smiled apologetically at her. She gave a helpless shrug and headed for the door. John and I had another couple of drinks, and then he whispered, "Let's go." The two of us slipped away from the crowd. By this time it was evening, and the street outside was quiet. Almost as soon as we left the pub, John kissed me, a long, passionate, irresistible kiss. He whispered that his friend Stuart had a room we could go to, grabbed my hand, and pulled me down the road. I was happy, hugely happy, to be with John, and that he felt the same. At that moment, I would have gone anywhere with him. Stuart's place was a large room at the back of a shared house, with no curtains, a mattress on the floor, and clothes, art materials, empty cigarette packets, and books scattered around it. We couldn't have cared less about the mess, and headed for the mattress, where we made love for the next hour. Afterward, John said, "Christ, Miss Powell, that was something else. What's all this about being engaged, then?" I told him that, in fact, I'd just broken off with a boy in Hoylake, and my romance was over. John grinned and said he thought I was incredibly sexy and he'd been lusting after me all term. "By the way," he added, "no more Miss Powell. From now on, your sin." We snapped back to reality when I realized I was about to miss my last train home. We pulled on our clothes and raced to the station, where we managed a hasty goodbye kiss before I leapt into a carriage. "What are you doing tomorrow, and the next day, and the next?" John called, as I waved out of the window. "Seeing you," I shouted back. From then on, we spent all our spare time together. We were always broke. Our small daily allowances went on fares, lunch, and in John's case, the ciggies he smoked. Park Drive, Woodbines, or Embassy, because they were the cheapest. Not to mention the pints of black velvet in Ye Crack at lunchtime or after college. If we had enough money, we went to the pictures, where we sat in the double seats at the back and kissed and cuddled, mostly ignoring whatever film was on, and often sitting through a couple of showings. More often, we didn't have any money at all, so we just walked and talked, or stretched out one drink in a pub or cafe. Before I started going out with John, I had been a conscientious student, completing all my work on time and putting in hours of effort. But John was a demanding lover who insisted that I put him before everything else, including college work, my friends, and my mother. Inevitably, my work took a nosedive, although I did my best to keep up. He was full of contradictions and confusion. He wanted proof daily that he mattered most to me. He was jealous of my close friendship with Phil, and even of my work, if I chose to spend an evening catching up with it instead of with him. Yet despite John's aggression and jealousy, I felt protective toward him. To me, he was a lost soul, and I wanted to give him understanding and acceptance and the security of being loved to ease his pain and bitterness. In college, I had a few admirers, although I wasn't aware of this until John pointed it out. He was incredibly jealous of any boy who came near me and wouldn't hesitate to warn them off. Not long after we got together, we went to a party at another student's flat. There was plenty of loud music, beer and cider, and we were having a good time until a very tall student I recognized from the sculpture department came over and asked me to dance. Before I could answer, all hell broke loose as John, in a blind fury, launched himself at the guy. The sculpture student was big enough to hold him off with one hand, but in the end everyone piled in to pull John away and eventually we calmed him down. The other guy, baffled by the uproar he had unwittingly caused, apologized for upsetting John and backed away. I felt frustrated by incidents like this. John had no need to worry. I would never have been unfaithful to him, and his overreaction embarrassed me. I tried repeatedly to reassure him, but it made no difference. John was provoked to fury if any other boy paid attention to me, however innocent. Frightening and demanding as John could be, he was also romantic, a side of him I saw more often as our relationship deepened. He wrote love poems on scraps of paper and passed them to me at college. For our first Christmas, he drew a card with a picture of me in my new shaggy coat standing opposite him, our heads together, his hand on my arm. It was covered with kisses and hearts, and he wrote, "Our first Christmas, I love you. Yes, yes, yes." A few years later, he used the same idea in one of the Beatles' first hits, "She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah." On the back of the card, he wrote, "I hope this won't be our last." I love that card and kept it in pride of place in my bedroom.
Tell you one more time, I think it's a sin. I think I let you down.
from the Beatles' second album, You Can't Do That. John Lennon was apparently a jealous lover. And right before that, we heard She Loves You. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm Kathy Geary, and you're listening to Now and Then. Today's program is the first of a two-part show celebrating the birthday of John Lennon coming up on October the 9th. And we're listening to some excerpts from a recording made by his first wife, Cynthia Lennon, from the book she published in 2005 entitled John.
The loss of a parent was one of the things we had in common and proved a powerful bond. Sometimes we talked to each other about how we felt. We both missed our parents terribly. But while I had basically come to terms with Dad's death, John was still angry about his mother Julia's senseless death in a car accident. I am certain that his bitter rage at his mother's death, and especially at the way she died, was behind so much of his aggression during that period. Music had been an important part of John's relationship with his mother. When she died, he used it to blot out the pain and anger he felt. Julia had bought him his first guitar and loved music. She played the piano and banjo and sat with him patiently for hours, showing him over and over again how to play the chords. She had also introduced John to rock and roll. She would play Elvis Presley records at top volume, grabbing John's hand to drive around the kitchen to them. She always encouraged John's musical dreams. By the time John and I got together, he talked, ate, breathed music. When he wasn't playing his guitar, he was writing lyrics or talking about the latest Lonnie Donegan, Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, or Chuck Berry record. Almost every lunchtime, he met the two other quarrymen to rehearse. They were both younger and went to the Liverpool Institute, next door to the Art College, the best known of Liverpool's boys' grammar schools. Distinguished judges and politicians had been educated there. Its pupils were expected to do well. But John's friends, Paul McCartney and George Harrison, were more interested in playing music than passing exams. John had met Paul at a fete at St. Peter's Church in Woolton when the quarrymen had played there almost 3 years earlier. On July the 6th, 1957. At 14, Paul was a year and 8 months younger than John, a fairly big age gap for teenagers. But when John realized that Paul was a talented musician who knew the words to dozens of hit songs and who could even tune his guitar, which John couldn't, his age was irrelevant. Soon afterward, John sent Paul a message via a friend. "You're in the group." George was a friend of Paul's. They'd started playing guitar together some time previously and practiced at each other's houses. Eventually, Paul introduced him to John. He was 8 months younger than Paul, but a talented guitarist. And in early 1958, John invited him to join the group. When I first met them, I was 19. John was 18, Paul was 17, and George 16. It was about as inconsequential as a meeting can be. Paul and George had come over to the Art College one lunchtime, and John said, "This is Paul and George, and this is Sin." And they both said hi, and I said hi, and that was it. As John's new girlfriend, they gave me a few curious glances, but then everyone got on with the serious business of making music. From the start, I loved their music. It was fascinating to watch them teach each other new chord sequences, work out the tunes to popular songs, and begin to put together their own. Paul had been first to write a song, but John leapt on the idea, and soon they were writing more and more new stuff. They had one of their first real breaks at the Casbah Club, a venue in the cellar of a house in a Liverpool suburb called West Derby. It belonged to Mona Best, who started the club as a meeting place for her elder son Peter and his friends. They charged a shilling membership to keep out the rough element and served coffee and sweets. Before they opened, Peter suggested to his mum that they ask one of the beat groups that were springing up all over town to come and play there. She agreed, and they invited the Quarrymen. A girl who knew the group had told the Bests how good they were. John, Paul and George went round to see Mona, who told them they were welcome to play, but she was still painting the cellar for the club's opening the following week. The three boys grabbed paintbrushes and helped her finish it off. The boys played at the club's opening on August the 29th, 1959, and I was there to watch them. They played without a drummer, as they couldn't find one. About 300 people came along that night, and the boys played rock and roll hits for a couple of hours. The place heaved with kids, jiving and swinging, and the temperature soared until it was hard to breathe. That was the evening when we first met the Beatles' future roadies, Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans, both friends of Pete. But Neil was also his mother's boyfriend and the father of his younger brother, Rogue. Eventually, Pete Best decided he wanted to be in a group, got himself a drum kit, and formed the Blackjacks with Ken Brown, who left the Quarrymen. They became the Casbah's resident group, and after that, the Quarrymen only played there occasionally. By the time I got to know Paul, he and John had formed a close partnership. They had agreed that any songs they wrote together, or separately, would be by Lennon and McCartney. It was as though even then they had a strong sense that their success depended on the connection between them. Paul's organized, conscientious way of going about things. He wrote down all the lyrics in a notebook he carried with him, was in sharp contrast to John's anything-goes style. Paul turned up for appointments on time, looking well turned out. He was a perfectionist, and you always knew he'd wash behind his ears. John arrived late, looking as though he'd just fallen out of bed. But they complimented each other. John needed Paul's attention to detail and persistence. Paul needed John's anarchic, lateral thinking. When they wrote songs together, Paul's gentler melodies blended beautifully with John's more rousing, challenging tunes and lyrics. In those days, Paul tried hard to impress John, posing and strutting with his hair slicked back to prove that he was cool, because John was very much the leader. It was his band, and he had the final say about who got in and who didn't and what they played. Then he was everything Paul wanted to be, laid back, self-assured, and in charge. As the schoolboy he still was, Paul could only aspire to these things. As the two became closer, this changed. John recognized Paul's musical talent and that he could learn from him. Paul responded by becoming more confident, and they came to share decisions and eventually ran the group together. But John, I suspect, always had the edge because he had formed the group and neither of them forgot it. Paul was one of the three people John was closest to. Although he had plenty of cronies, he only let down his guard with Paul, me and Stuart Sutcliffe. Slight, dark and intense, Stuart was serious and hard-working, unlike John, who played the lazy loon. Everyone knew that Stuart was a gifted artist who would go far. He even had a private commission for a painting, unheard of for a student. When John saw his large, colourful canvases, he loved them and longed to try something similar. Before that, he had limited himself to the cartoons and caricatures he drew so brilliantly and which had got him into college.
We're listening to Cynthia Lennon reading from the book she published in 2005 about her early romance and marriage to John Lennon. The Quarrymen. I have a very unusual recording made in 1960 in Paul McCartney's bedroom upstairs for a Quarrymen rehearsal with George Harrison, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and his good friend Stuart Sutcliffe on bass. This is not a great produced recording, but it's so fascinating to hear the Quarrymen in rehearsal in 1960. We'll hear a few songs that feature John as an early performer. When Your Heartaches Begin, followed by Hello Little Girl, That'll Be the Day, and I'll Always Be in Love with You. This is the Quarrymen in rehearsal. Thank you.
First record we ever made with the Beatles in a little studio in
Somebody in the world is me, and I will hold.
John's teenage years were punctuated by tragic losses. The first was his beloved Uncle George, Mimi's husband. He collapsed at home one Sunday afternoon and died instantly from a massive liver hemorrhage. His death came without any warning, and to John, who was 14 and had looked on George as a father, it was a terrible shock. His mother's death 3 years later also came out of the blue. One July evening, she had been round to Mimi's for a cup of tea and a chat. Despite their past disagreements, the two still got on well, and like the other Stanley sisters, loved gossiping over a pot of tea. John wasn't there. Julia had left him at her own house with Bobby and the girls. When Julia left to catch her bus home, Mimi waved her off. Sometimes she walked with her to the bus stop, but that night she didn't. Seconds later, Julia was hit by a car as she crossed the road outside Mimi's house. She died instantly. That night, a policeman broke the news to John and Bobby. John's little sisters were in bed, and as Bobby's mother was there, John and Bobby went to Sefton General Hospital, where Julia had been taken. John couldn't bear to see her, but Bobby went in to say goodbye. When he came out, he collapsed in tears in John's arms. John went to her funeral in a daze, unable to believe that his vibrant, laughing mother was inside the wooden coffin everyone was filing past. Her death was made worse for everyone by the fact that the man who killed her was a drunk off-duty policeman and a learner driver who had apparently hit the accelerator instead of the brake when he saw Julia crossing. When he went to court, he was acquitted of the charges, and the only punishment he received was a reprimand and a period of suspension from duty.
Half of what I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, sing the song of love, Julia. Julia, seashell eyes, windy smile calls me. So I sing the song of love, Julia. Sky is shimmering, glimmering in the sun. Julia, Julia, morning moon, touch me. So I sing the song of love, Julia.
I'm Kathy Geary, and you've been listening to Now and Then here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Today's program, a tribute to John Lennon, whose birthday is coming up on October the 8th. I hope you enjoyed the program today, and thank you so much for listening. Support for this program comes from our listeners and from the Cooperage, 1030 Main Street, Honesdale. Be entertained, be challenged, be inspired. The Cooperage Project.org.